Get deeper insights on the news from inside sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. It's great to be with you today. As always, I am Boyd Matheson. You know, one of the things that we do very well in the United States of America is moments. We come together in moments of tragedy, big catastrophes, natural disasters. We're really good at that. We're less good at the forward movement and remembering. And we've seen so many of these moments of coming together, but we've seen far more where we just kind of keep going on and we forget the lessons or we miss the lessons in their entirety. And someone who never misses a moment or a message is Kelsey Dallas. Of course, a great writer for Deseret.com, Deseret News. She has a master's degree in religion from Yale Divinity and covers a wide range of topics. One of the great thinkers and great writers we have around here. And Kelsey, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for those kind words, and thanks for having me.
I am so excited to talk about this because you've done something that I think we're just missing in the country, and you actually went back to a site of one of those tragic moments where the country did come together. You went back to Pittsburgh, to the synagogue there. First, remind us of the events that we should be remembering and learning from, and then start to share your experience of going back.
Yes, I went to the site of the Pittsburgh synagogue shooting that took place on October 27th, 2018. That was the deadliest attack on Jews in U.S. history. 11 men and women died and others were injured. There were actually three separate Jewish congregations affected who were sharing the same building. And when I was at the Religion News Association conference this past weekend, we were able to go visit the site where the main synagogue is still standing, but the site of the shooting, which was more of a community center and smaller chapel, has been torn down to make room for a very exciting new project that we could talk about more later. But really what I wanted to write about in my newsletter was what it felt like to be there, what it's like to see what hangs around the site today, which is copies of drawings that the community received from school children across the country back in 2018, messages like, you are so loved, you matter, move forward together, and just what it felt like to talk to the people who went through that tragedy and the lessons that they walked away with.
Yeah, and so describe some of that for us, some of those conversations that you had. I think, again, noting that it was the deadliest attack on the Jewish community, 11 people lost their lives, many others injured, and again, the country came together. There was a moment, I think, where everyone kind of focused their attention on that, and then, of course, we all started moving on to the next thing and the next thing after that. So give us a sense of the conversations. I loved the visual images there of those drawings of rebuild together and be happy and all of those. What else did you hear? What else did you sense walking around?
The folks that were directly affected, so it touched on their own congregation or their own loved ones may have passed away. They talked about how they had to work through the typical mourning process. They had to work through the trauma. And they also had to decide what to do with the national attention, international attention on them. Mm. And what they've sort of realized over the past 5.5 or so years is that these really dark moments are also an opportunity to remind people of the power of coming together, as you were speaking about. And so now their mission is to not just tell the story of tragedy, but also to tell of the joys that they had the opportunity to feel thanks to the community response, and to say, how can we build a community spirit that is with us always and not just in these dark moments? So their goal with the site is to build a community center, a center that educates people about anti-Semitism, but also a center of celebration where you could go to a community event and get to know your neighbors and just become more engaged, and so that we could support each other all the time and not just difficult times.
Yeah, so great. I love one of the lines that you used in terms of celebrating the kindness and compassion of the world, even as you call out evil. Those things don't have to be polar opposites. You can actually have an and conversation in celebrating that kindness and compassion, and you can still call out evil.
Yes, and They also talked quite a bit about how they want their loved ones that died that day to be known for more than just dying that day. Mm. So they've worked on a memorial that will sit next to the synagogue that will talk about how these 11 men and women lived their lives, the things they cared about, their investment in Pittsburgh's Jewish community. And that's an important reminder as well. That I've read a lot about. I think David Brooks writes about where it's like developing your virtues throughout your life and not just focusing on what's on your resume, for example. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I just felt so inspired personally by this visit, but also felt like it was a message that civic leaders need to hear, religious leaders need to hear, anyone who's in a position of authority where they can focus on educating folks with an eye toward bringing people together and not just educating folks so that they're like scared of the next terrible tragedy or memorize all the details of this particular shooting. Like really it's about how do you collect the wisdom and then move forward.
I love that. And it really is a reminder, as you wrote in your piece, of what's possible when we pull together instead of pulling apart. And I think it's also that principle that we actually honor best those who have gone before by living our lives with excellence today. And to me, this just feels like what is next, what happens next is what matters, that we can really celebrate those who lost their lives by living differently, coming together and doing something together today is a wonderful message. And as you said, Kelsey, we need that in every civic corner and every political space on the planet, especially right here at home. Kelsey, thanks so much for joining us again. As always, great thinking, great writing. Thanks for pulling us into a compelling story that matters. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, that's Kelsey Dallas again from Deseret News, Deseret.com. Great piece there. And again, coming out of that tragedy of the Pittsburgh shooting there in that Jewish community, 11 lives lost, and now so many lives touched, blessed, strengthened, enlightened, with a bigger vision of what's possible when we pull together. We can't just have moments in times of that are bad. We have to have the vision and foresight to take action to create what's next. We'll be right back.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
As we continue to march our way through the 2024 election cycle, of course, a lot of attention on the presidential politics of it all, which will culminate in the first Tuesday of November. We also have some important big races here in the state of Utah, which will put new people in a variety of positions, including the role of attorney general. One of those who is running to fill that office is Derek Brown, and he joins us live on the line. Derek, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Boyd. Appreciate you having me.
So you've been out and about with delegates, doing cottage meetings, having all kinds of gatherings, making your case there. And that's always an interesting experience to be out amongst voters, potential voters, delegates. Tell me something that you have learned in that process and maybe something that has even surprised you as you've been going through this race for the attorney general spot.
Well, I mean, I've learned that there is a lot of angst out there and a lot of people really interested in what takes place in even the local races here in Utah. But I've enjoyed the fact that so many people are engaged, and we have 4,000 Republican delegates. And I've been at events where they're literally taking notes as I'm speaking, which means that they're comparing and contrasting the candidates and really doing their job. And so anyway, I've been pleasantly surprised, and quite frankly, Boyd, it's a little unnerving when someone's taking notes when you're speaking, but that's a good thing, right? I mean, I like the fact that there is that level of engagement.
Yeah, I think that's such an important thing. And it is always refreshing to see how serious people take it and leaning into that process of being an informed voter. I think we all can take some lessons there as well. So give us a little bit of the why story for you in choosing to take on this particular race at this particular time.
Well, I think for me, this is a moment in time it's an opportunity to serve, an opportunity to give back. I've always believed that you take the George Washington model, you get in, you serve, you step up, and then you step out. And I've always felt very strongly about that model. I did that in the House of Representatives. I was in the state house. I served for a few years. I had an opportunity to help Senator Lee out, so I stepped out. Same thing with the state party. I was the GOP state chair for a couple of years, and when it was over, I had people saying, hey, go do another round. You know, this one will be easier, and it'll be more of a – one person called it a victory lap because all the hard stuff had been done. And I said, you know what? Service isn't about victory laps. It's about getting stuff done and then getting back to the private sector. And I feel like we are at a critical point in time as a state and as a country, particularly as it involves the federal government and the level of just overreach into every aspect of our life. And this is an issue I've been working on for 20 plus years, ever since I practiced law with Senator Lee. 20 plus years ago in Washington, it's an issue that I care about, I've been working on. And so I feel like this is a moment where I can make a difference. I can serve and do what I've done before, step up, serve, and then step out.
Yeah. It's so interesting. I'm going to get my disclaimer in here that about 8 years ago, maybe a little more than 8 years ago, I was part of a hiring process that took you out of that private sector and put you in a Senate office as a deputy chief of staff. And a lot of people look at those kinds of transitions and they kind of wonder what's going on there. And often those come at a cost. I know that your wife, Emily, has had similar things that my wife, Debbie, has had when you come home and say, hey, we've got a new opportunity. And she says, how much is it going to cost us? what kind of pay cut are we going to take to do this? But you've had those kind of moments where you've said, okay, I've got this great offer in hand, but I think I have an opportunity to make a difference and not just a dollar. Describe that for us.
Well, it is. I mean, it is a trade-off. I mean, public service is called that for a reason. And we've joked that every time I've had an opportunity to do really well financially, that I've blown it by going into public service. But, when you feel that gentle nudge to serve, I think you answer that call. And I've had a lot of people that have said to me, one of these days I want to run for office. What should I do now? And I said, well, be part of your community. Serve where you can. Learn a skill, be involved, and I promise the moment will come. And I've had so many friends who've had a moment, whether it's the Planning Commission or the State House of Representatives or something in their community. I mean, when that moment comes and you get that, the nudge to serve, that's the time. And so I encourage everyone to look for those opportunities, because that's really what this is about. Politics should not be a profession. It should be, brief periods of time where you get in, you use your talents and abilities to help those around you, and then you transition to doing, going back to doing what you were doing before.
Yeah, I think that's an important part of that model, to get in, to make a difference, to get back out, because we do need it in community. And then when you're in community, that tap on the shoulder moment comes, and you're ready, you're prepared, you can do that for a season, and then you move on to the next thing. Well, Derek, as we close out, I'm going to close with a question I ask every single person running for office. I've asked people running for president of the United States, to local mayors, county commissioners, everybody in between. And you have experienced the rough and tumble of politics. It's hard. It's exhausting. It's exasperating. It's hard on families. It's hard on professions. It's hard on everything. And so the question is, what makes all of this worthwhile for you, even if you get to the end of the day and you don't become the next attorney general?
That's a great question. For me, this has been an opportunity to raise awareness and let people know that we have this critical, crucial moment in time where I think we are positioned to make an impact as a state and as a country as it relates to federal overreach and so many of these conservative issues that I care about. And if in the end the voters choose someone else, what will make it worthwhile for me is if the person they chose is someone who is qualified, aware of, and able to really address those issues, because we really are at a critical turning point in this country right now. And so if that's where this ends up, if that's where this leads it, and if the voters choose someone else, fantastic. As long as we're able to address some of the biggest issues that we are facing as a state, and we're well positioned to do that. So that's my hope. That's what would make it all worthwhile for me.
All right. Derrick Brown running for the Attorney General's office here in the state of Utah. Big convention coming up on Saturday, of course, and then on to the June 25th primary. We'll continue to keep our eye on all of those things. Derrick, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, boy. Appreciate it.
All right. Again, that's Derrick Brown running for Attorney General here in the state of Utah. And KSL News Radio has you covered with everything you're going to need rolling, not just into this weekend where you have both the Democrats and the Republicans having their conventions, and then those will pivot and move on to the June 25th primary. And so a lot going on, and I love the fact that we can get in and become a little more educated, understand just a little bit better what are the core issues. I love to look at how people think, what makes them tick. Because that often will tell you how they'll vote, how they'll lead, or how they will govern. But you can't get that from bumper stickers or just sailing across and just looking at the headlines. And again, big thanks to Derrick Brown. We're going to go ahead and step aside for a quick commercial break. When we come back, we're going to look at the Utah Senate race for the U.S. Senate. And we'll have Brent Hatch joining us on the line coming up next on KSL News Radio. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Elevated conversation on crucial issues. Boyd Matheson on Inside Sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. It's great to be with you today. As always, I am Boyd Matheson. As we continue our coverage on the races that will impact the state and the nation here in the Beehive State and beyond, of course, we continue to keep our eye on the United States Senate race. One of those candidates vying for that spot is Brent Orrin Hatch, and he joins us live on the line. And Brent, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Boyd. I'm glad you have me on.
So give us a little sense here. Obviously, you have been in, around, and through the political space and public service, obviously with your father's time there in our nation's capital. Give us a sense of what was the moment that made you decide, I need to get into this race now?
Well, it's pretty much the same thing delegates have said to me as we've gone up and down the states. They said, you know, we've got a lot of people who are, you know, giving conservative talking points, but we need somebody with experience. And I've been a practicing lawyer here for 30 years, but earlier in my career, I worked for the conservative justice, Judge Robert Bork. I worked in the Reagan administration, both as the youngest general counsel in the history of the government, but also as in the Justice Department. I was the first Utahn to work in the White House as Associate White House Counsel. And as you mentioned, I'm also the oldest son of the late Senator Orrin Hatch, and had a front row seat to what he did and to be effective representing our great state in Washington. So the delegates have liked the fact that with all the experience I have, that I'm more than just talking points. I actually have the experience and qualities to actually get something done.
Yeah, I actually wanted to ask you about that time as associate counsel to the president there in the White House under George H.W. Bush. We actually had one of his chief of staffs on who's had a great book talking about character matters and some of those lessons. They said that George H.W. Bush never gave advice. He lived advice. As you saw that in that role, what did you learn and how has that helped shape what you would hope to be as a United States senator?
Well, both presidents I worked for, Presidents Reagan and Bush, were unbelievable conservatives, and the most defining characteristic that they were dignified. Everything about them just exuded confidence, strength, and that they cared about people. And I learned a lot from that, because being a conservative isn't just yelling and screaming. It's actually getting things done.
Yeah, I think that sharpening more pencils than knives, I think, is something that the conservative movement's got to get back to in terms of kind of a governing philosophy. As you look at the way things are shaping up in the country, obviously there's a lot of shouting going on in the country, including what's happening on college campuses today. How do you see that? What's the cause of that? And what's the role of the United States Senator in helping shape the kinds of conversations we have about the big issues of our time?
Well, one of the things I've been talking to delegates about is under our constitutional system, the federal government's supposed to be limited, and most issues are supposed to be dealt with at the state level. We've gotten to a position where so many people want everything to be a federal issue that every issue becomes the Super Bowl. Instead of letting our states be laboratories of democracy and letting us, you know, compete for ideas, have them handled at the local state levels where we're more likely to get agreements in the state of Utah among our citizens than having to fight it out with Californians and New Yorkers. And so, you know, getting back to, you know, limited government and constitutional principles, I think is important. That'll get rid of some of the divisiveness and partisanship we have in government now.
Yeah. And so as you've been having these conversations with delegates, with potential voters out there, I always like to ask, has anything surprised you as you've crisscrossed the state, really listening and finding out what's on their minds?
Yeah, there's a lot of things. One of the things that my father did very well is he actually, you know, he went up and down the state. There's almost not a single government official that didn't meet with them or he didn't have some impact on their lives. And going up and down the state, most of them have been telling me that, that's really lacked with the representatives that we've had over the last several years. So they don't feel like they're being listened to, their problems aren't being resolved, and they'd like to get back to good conservative leadership that also cares about them, especially in rural Utah.
Yeah, and so final question for you, and this is one I've asked everybody from presidential candidates to mayors, city council, everybody in between. I think it's the important question, and that is, what makes all of this worth it? You've seen enough of the rough and tumble of what politics is and can be, how brutal it can be. What makes all of that worth it, even if in the end you don't get the result you want?
Well, I learned it very early in my career, working on Judge Bork's nomination to the Supreme Court, that politics could be a blood sport and you had to have a thick skin. But one of the things I learned also was to continue to fight, continue to make a difference. For 38 years, I've worked both in the Justice Department and the White House and as a private citizen and as a board of directors member of the Federalist Society to get conservative justices on the court, Supreme Court. And I've worked personally in almost every one of those. And under President Trump, we got him to put three conservatives on the Supreme Court. Now we have a 6-3 majority, and we're starting to see the effect of that. And that will last beyond several presidencies. And I think, you know, that was very fulfilling to me. It also, I think, is a good sign to the delegates and the people of the state that I've been a strong conservative my entire life, my entire career. I haven't wavered. And nobody's done anything close to having the impact as changing the Supreme Court has had.
Yeah, no question about that. Great insight. Brent Orrin-Hatch, you're running for the slot for the United States Senate. We appreciate you joining us on the line. Good luck down the home stretch and over the weekend at the convention. And I'm sure we will be talking to you as things roll along. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I hope the delegates will vote Hatch at the convention.
All right. That's Brent Orrin-Hatch. And again, coming up this weekend, we'll have coverage for you here on KSL News Radio. Both the Republicans and the Democrats will have their nominating conventions over the weekend. Those will be fascinating to watch how those play out. A lot of those will result in primaries that, of course, will take place June the 25th when those primary days are held. But there's a lot to watch. There's a lot of things that can happen. And as is always the case in politics, 24 to 48 hours is a lifetime or two or three when it comes to politics. So I'm very interested to see how things continue to play out, what the conversations continue to be. There's always a little bit of a flurry, especially as it relates to these conventions for both political parties, that in the last hours before those conventions, there's usually some shenanigans by someone who's a little overambitious or a little overanxious or really trying to sway them in a particular way. And so I always caution people, this applies leading up to a primary, leading up to a general election, leading up to a convention. If it sounds a little wild, it probably is. If it sounds a little crazy, it's probably not reality. And so we have to dismiss and make sure we don't reward the bad behavior of some who are so desperate for power that they'll do anything to get it. That's the last person you want to actually have representing you in the end. So we appreciate those candidates that are staying on their message and their vision, worrying less about their opponents, less about the attacks, and much more about what are their principles, what policies are they going to put forward, what's their vision for what's next. That's what actually matters. All right, that rounds out hour number one of Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. We'll step aside for some top of the hour news, but do not go anywhere. We got a big hour number two coming up for you. We're going to kick it off with some radical empathy of Passover. You don't want to miss it. Stick around.
KSL FM Midvale.
KSL Salt Lake City.
From the KSL Common Spirit Health Studios, this is KSL News Radio.
Utah's news, traffic, and weather station.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
The holiday of Passover is currently being celebrated by Jewish people around the world, and most of us can rattle off the headline of all of that, that it's about remembrance of their exodus from Egypt. But what if we need to think again about what we think we know about Passover, and what if beyond the headline there's actually a radical message in Passover that's more vital now than ever before? Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day? Think again with Boyd Matheson on KSL News Radio.
We began on Monday of this week. We had a great conversation with Rabbi Brad Hirschfeld from New York about some of the things that are underneath the headlines of Passover. We want to continue that conversation with just a brilliant piece in the New York Times that is actually titled Passover's Radical Message is More Vital Than Ever. And Shai Held from the Hayder Institute as the president and dean, which he co-founded. He's also the author of Judaism is About Love. And looking forward to this conversation. And Shai, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start with this radical message. Most people understand the core message of or the baseline message, I would say, in terms of Passover and history. But help us get beyond that.
Well, one of the most interesting aspects, I think, of the Exodus in the Hebrew Bible is the idea that it has a radical, ethical, political message. And that is that because we were strangers in the land of Egypt, we were vulnerable outsiders, we take upon ourselves a kind of special sensitivity to those who are vulnerable in the societies we find ourselves in. That's called loving the stranger. And I think it's actually quite radical because it's possible to say, you know, we were oppressed, no one helped us, so we don't owe anybody anything. But instead, the Bible encourages the Jewish people and all of its readers to say, we were oppressed, no one helped us, therefore we will never turn our back on those who are oppressed.
I love that. There's so many lessons just in that piece alone in terms of, one, the earned empathy, of course, but then also that ability to talk with authenticity about the stranger, about those that we disagree with, about those that maybe have a different way of thinking, believing, praying, worshiping, or living. And so how do we start to apply that? How do we start to look at that, especially in the context of some of the bigger challenges we have in the world today?
Well, you know, the first meaning of stranger in the Bible, which, you know, in older translations, the Hebrew word ger was translated as sojourner. Mm. The meaning of stranger, I mean, its primary meaning, we start there at least, is someone who is not part of the kin group and therefore is vulnerable to being exploited by those with much more power than they. So the first piece of this is a kind of sensitivity to people who are vulnerable and subject to abuse and exploitation. And we could have all kinds of conversations about who those people are in any given society at any given time. But there is this kind of clear thrust of those who are vulnerable are your responsibility. That is of a piece with the Bible's idea that God loves widows and orphans, right? That is the paradigmatic vulnerable people in a society become the responsibility of God's people.
Yeah.
In general, to your question more directly, I think there's a kind of project of insistently seeing the humanity of those we might be tempted to dehumanize.
Yeah, that fellow. I'm sorry. Keep going.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was going to say that seeing that fellow traveler, that fellow sojourner, or those who may be apart but should be treated as if they are within. I think it is such an important part of that. And there was one piece that you had in your piece in the New York Times that talks about suffering in particular, and that on one hand it can teach us that love, that earned empathy, but we also have to be careful because if we're not careful, then we tend to be led towards apathy and even indifference. Just unpack that for us.
Yeah, I would say apathy, indifference, and sometimes even cruelty You know, I'll give you an example of this. When I was starting out as a rabbi in the late 90s, I was living in Boston, and it was right when the archdiocese, the Catholic Archdiocese of Boston, was unraveling because of all of the sexual abuse scandals. And the thing that I was most struck by as a rabbi, just kind of following these stories, is how many of the victimizers had been victims themselves as kids, right? How many people who had become grotesque abusers had themselves been abused? And so that really brought home for me the reality that this takes a lot of work. Letting your suffering teach you love as opposed to hate or even just entitlement takes work. You have to know the ways that you've been wounded and the ways that you've been hurt. And you have to work on really cultivating love and empathy. And it's that revolution in empathy that I'm trying to call for.
Yeah, and that is radical. And I love that. And I also love that you point out that this kind of work, to live up to that kind of radical idea, is both individual and communal. Help us understand that.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting because the Bible seems to be speaking both to individuals. Sometimes when it articulates this mandate, it articulates it in the singular, right? You must love the stranger, you singular. And then sometimes it articulates in the plural. You the group, must love the stranger. So I find that really kind of suggestive, because it suggests that on the one hand, this is a big societal question. How do we build a society that welcomes the outsider? But it's also a deeply personal question, a kind of a place where spirituality and ethics meet. How do I, as an individual, respond to seeing people who are vulnerable in my world? How awake am I to their suffering? How responsive am I to their needs? I think that's really, really fundamental.
Yeah, no question. And finally, we always like to get to the therefore what question. As people read your piece in the New York Times, as they think about and hear different things about Passover or experience Passover during this week, what is it that you hope we think different, or what do you hope we do different as a result?
Well, you know, I would say two things on very different levels. One is that we work on the kind of practice of noticing people who tend to be invisible to us, whether it's the person at our synagogue or church that no one says hello to, whether it's, you know, the homeless person who we treat as if they're not there, right? To simply start seeing, insisting on seeing those whom society renders invisible. And then I would say, on a much larger scale, you know, so many of the world's most painful conflicts, including the one in Palestine and Israel, ultimately, if we're ever going to find our way out of those conflicts, it's going to be through people being willing to show the courage to hear one another's stories and see one another's pain. So although it seems so far away so much of the time, empathy really is obviously, I think, core to any future answers and solutions.
Such important stuff. It is the radical empathy of Passover, and I just want to reinforce what we have just heard, that it is the courage to hear one another's stories, to feel where they are coming from, is the beginning of change and transformation individually and as a society, and recognizing that when we link arms, we move this forward together in a very, very different way. Rabbi Shai Held, president and dean of the Hayter Institute, which he co-founded, also the author of Judaism is About Love. And thank you so much for making time for us during this Passover week. You've given us a lot to think about and a lot to do about to make things just a little bit better. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, that's Rabbi Shai Held, president and dean of the Hayter Institute. And I had not thought about empathy as something radical. The radical empathy of Passover. We've learned some important things this week in terms of how we can apply things that happened thousands of years ago to some very real, very acute, very specific problems in our world today. But it does start with some radical empathy. We'll be right back.
Think again on Inside Sources with Boyd Matheson. Boyd Matheson divides rage from reason on Inside Sources.
Public service is always an interesting path, And, of course, as we march our way through the 2024 election cycle, we see the rough and tumble of it. We see the ways that can often be so exhausting and exasperating, at times infuriatingly unfair. And it's all part of public service. And that's exactly what it is, public service. And it's not for everyone. It takes someone who has some thick skin and has a real clear vision of what matters and what principles they're going to live by, what they're going to stand up for, where they're going to yield and negotiate and get to compromise, and the things that are the non-negotiables. And we often think about that at a high level as voters, as we cast votes, but sometimes we don't watch what happens afterwards. And that's the important part. It's the hard work and heavy lifting stuff that really makes public service public service. It's often thankless. It's often late nights, early mornings, and all kinds of stressors in between. But from time to time, it's important that we step back and we stop and we recognize those who have had influence, who've made a difference, who've left a legacy of service, and who continue to make a difference in our community and in our country. And we're really pleased to have back on the program Matt Sangren, of course, is the executive director of the Orrin Hatch Foundation. And Matt, welcome back to the show.
And Boyd, it's good to be with you. Just hearing your introduction, you sound kind of like a recovering, hardened Senate staffer. It's always good to be with you. One of the reasons why I enjoy coming on your show, we both can commiserate and trade notes on, you know, our wounds from the Hill. So it's good to be with you.
That's right. There's plenty of scar tissue to go around, and but we should celebrate scar tissue. It's how things actually get done. And it is often those staffers that that make all the things happen and move along. I was just mentioning not too long ago that we had George H.W. Bush, someone who served as his chief of staff for longer, who just came out with a new book, Character Matters. And I loved this whole thing that she kept saying, you know, he never gave advice, but he always lived advice. And that's really, I think, some of the work that you're doing at the Orrin Hatch Foundation, including we get to break some news here today. Your Titan of Public Service Award is coming back around, and we know who it is now, or we're about to know
who
it is.
Right. Well, we're about to announce, as you might recall, last year we began this award, the Titan of Public Service Award. We kicked it off pretty high bar with Senate Republican Leader Mitch McConnell and his wife, Secretary Elaine Chao, two-time secretary, cabinet secretary, and we honored them last August of 2023. But this year, we're continuing our stride, and we're pleased to announce that this year's award recipient is Senator John Thune of South Dakota. Now, for those who may not know Senator Thune, he serves as a Senate Republican whip. Now, that might sound a little like an inside Beltway term, but it's the second most senior member of the Republican leadership team. It's a big deal. And he actually, to add a little more to him and his heft, he just recently announced his candidacy to run for Senate Republican leader this November. Mm. So we're just thrilled to bring him to Salt Lake City. He will be coming on Wednesday, August 14th. We'll be holding the event, the gala, at the Grand America Hotel in Salt Lake City, right downtown. It'll be a wonderful event.
Yeah, that is great. And last year's event was really extraordinary and a really candid conversation, I thought, with Leader McConnell and Secretary Chao, that gave some great insight. Again, kind of the behind the scenes of what makes all of those things actually happen. John Thune is someone who, even if people don't know, if they saw him, they'd say, oh, got to be a senator. Like, he's right out of central casting. But as the Republican whip, it is a lot of the behind-the-scenes stuff. I remember during my time in D.C., him and his office really being about the communication strategy that was equal to the policy strategy. And so there's a lot of things under there that maybe we don't know about John Thune that I think are worthy of this Titan of Public Service Award.
Oh, not only is he a gentleman and his policy chops are just amazing, but something that we don't know, he's tall. He plays basketball, and he's got it. He's got his game, and he's plays in the Senate gym regularly. He will not disappoint. But, you know, I just want to pivot back to the Hatch Foundation for a moment. You know, we spend a lot of time. We get involved in public policy through our reports and our op-eds, and We're pleased with that, but we love bringing folks together within the community. And our convening power, in my view, is second to none. And we thrive in bringing some of our nation's top political voices to Utah. So I hope your listeners will take us up on this opportunity. It's a big deal to bring some of these, I would say, political heavyweights to the Beehive State. For those who are interested and want to attend, ticket and sponsorship opportunities available on our website at orrinhatchfoundation.org. That's with two R's, O-R-R-I-N, hatchfoundation.org. Boy, it's going to be a great night. I know you like to come to it, and I hope you'll plan on coming this year.
Well, we'll stick that right on the calendar, and it will be a good one. And it is one of the things that the Hatch Foundation does amazingly well, is that power to convene. And sometimes you think of that in the context of just big events, but it's bringing thought leaders into spaces for crucial conversations. And you've done that not only in with your Titan of Public Service Awards, but there's so many others, including some of these extraordinary debates that have been held in amazing places. And so I do think that ability to convene and bring thought leaders together for thoughtful conversations, thoughtful debate, not kumbaya moments, but real policy debate is really second to none. And Matt, thanks so much for joining us today. Very excited. Worthy nomination and recipient of the 2024 Titan of Public Service Award to John Thune. Again, that event will be held August 14th in Salt Lake City, and you can find all the information there at the Orrin G. Hatch Foundation. You can check them out online as well. Matt, thanks so much for joining us today. Always appreciate
it. Thank you, Boyd.
All right, we're going to go ahead and step aside for some bottom-of-the-hour news, and when we come back, more Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. Stick around.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Well, our nation's been debating about the right action that could, should, or would be taken regarding climate and environmental policy for a long time. Often pretty divisive in how we've gone about that. Different voices have different ideas about the best course of action to take. And while we all want to leave the planet in a little better condition than we found it and make it better for those who will follow after us, there's an important and crucial voice that's often missing in the big battles and the hyperpartisan rhetoric that we often see when we talk about climate and environment. And that a crucial voice is the American taxpayer. So how do we start having an kind of conversation and a better conversation to produce better outcomes? Devin Hartman is with the R Street Institute, had a great piece in the Washington Examiner today talking about the fact that taxpayers need to be included in all of this clean conversation. And Devin, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
So obviously Earth Week this week, it's the annual reminder of all of those things. Give us your sense in terms of where are we in this conversation and how do we get to that better conversation that does include the voice of the people as well?
Absolutely. So you teed it up very nicely. So Earth Week is usually that week where, you know, all the Greens are very excited. We're thinking about environmental stewardship and our responsibility to future generations. And then the taxpayer groups are cringing because the green agenda historically has been very antagonistic to taxpayer interests. And that's unfortunate. It doesn't have to be the case. And in fact, a lot of the secret sauce of what has been working to really reduce emissions and what will work going forward, the really key catalysts are things that actually are beneficial to taxpayer interests. Mm. So it's really about shifting the narrative from climate progress is as measured in a political proxy by how much taxpayers are forced to spend to let's focus on what mechanisms unleash private capital to solve a problem that they're already willing to go after, even without subsidies.
Yeah. And so let's dive into that, because I think that's worth unpacking today, because usually we get teed up with the fake fight and the false choice. You either, you know, want to put an oil rig under Delicate Arch in southern Utah, or, you know, you're just going to shut down everything and we're going to, you know, go back to no gas, no cars, no electricity, no anything. And obviously the better conversations in between. But you put forward in your piece some of the things that we have to get in there, and you alluded to one of those, which I think is real crucial, and that is dealing with the subsidizing, government subsidizing our way to deal with climate. Explain that for us.
Sure. So usually sort of like the green orthodoxy that's kind of persisted for the last couple decades is to really pick certain technologies and then either mandate it or subsidize it. And that can reduce emissions, and it used to be somewhat more effective in the past, but it always ran afoul sort of consumer taxpayer interests. But what we're seeing with market conditions moving forward is that markets are extremely motivated to deploy clean capital already. The real issue is the red tape hanging up the process here. And so what we're actually seeing is that the things that are really the drivers of clean energy, in particular in this country, it's more like a kinked hose, and subsidies really just turn up the pressure, but you're not getting much more throughput because you really have to address the bottleneck in the kinked hose. And so even just one category of regulatory reform would have more emissions reduction than the entire Inflation Reduction Act. And that was considered to be like the hallmark piece of legislation. And I think a big thing that people are starting to realize now is that legislation, which originally passed a couple of years ago, thinking, yeah, it'll be about a $370 billion hit on the clean energy side for taxpayers, but maybe it's just a one-time thing. It pushes us through this decade, and then these technologies stand on their own. But what we're actually seeing is that there's a condition in there that won't be met because of the regulatory environment being so restrictive. And that is going to put taxpayers probably on the hook for trillions of dollars. And it's mostly going to subsidize what the private sector is trying to build anyways and oftentimes can't get regulatory approval for.
Yeah, and so often that is the case. You end up hurting the very thing you want to help, and the
exactly.
Regulatory thing becomes such a big issue. And we've had several people on this show talking about how frustrated they are because they were excited about a particular kind of energy or a new technology that was emerging or a cleaner way to do something, but they can't even start because of the red tape, because of the regulation. And so a lot of these things included in the Inflation Reduction Act haven't even started because it takes years and years to get through the red tape, the regulatory, the lawsuits, and all of those things, all the while slowing down that innovation because we're subsidizing some other things at the same time.
Absolutely. And I think a big way to kind of bridge the divide here is to frame it from like a more of a moral framework. We have a responsibility to future generations to leave them with a wealthier and cleaner world. And we can only do that if we have our financial house in order and we're good stewards of the environment. And we have to be cognizant of what policy architecture delivers on that. And sometimes there's trade-offs between the two objectives, and you have to make sure the good outweighs the bad. We don't do that sometimes, but a lot of times we overlook how much bad public policy is already in place. And if we remove those impediments, we can not only drive emissions reductions much quicker, but we can also better adapt to climate change. Think of all the subsidies that we have right now in place that actually put people in harm's way. We encourage people in many cases to develop in areas that are very prone to wildfire risk or severe drought, or right in the middle of the worst path line for hurricanes. We can't be subsidizing that behavior because we're then reducing the market signal, especially in the insurance industry, to appropriately respond to that risk. And as climate change worsens, we need to make sure we're not diluting that signal from the risk. We need to make sure that the private sector has the freedom to price that risk and let individuals respond.
Yeah, so important. And I love the way you framed this in your piece at the Washington Examiner, talking about, again, it's an and conversation that we can get the taxpayers and the environmental interests. We can have good stewardship of the land, and we can do things that are good for the American people, for the economy, and for all of those things. I want to spend just one quick minute on the subsidy piece, because I don't think we highlight that enough, that sometimes when government is picking the winners and losers by subsidizing usually organizations that have an army of lawyers and lobbyists, that we often cut out a lot of the real innovation in the market. And even on things like solar panels, you had some of that great innovation going on, but then you had this massive Solyndra piece of the puzzle and all of those subsidies. And suddenly the innovation that everybody wants for the environment actually gets slowed down because of what's happening on that front.
Exactly. The thing that we want out of the clean industries is we want them to be competing in the marketplace in a way that drives innovation, because competitive enterprise is motivated to cut costs. When you dilute that signal with subsidies, the competition that should be happening in the marketplace shifts to a competition to receive subsidies. And there's a whole new industry that's been stood up here in D.C. just to secure the massive amount of pork that the federal government is handing out here. And I can't tell you how many of the entities that are lining up with their hands out to get this funding will privately admit on the side, we don't actually need it. But obviously, we want to make sure we get it so we can report that back to our shareholders. And that's their responsibility. But guess what? The power of American industry would be much better spent not trying to milk taxpayers, but out there competing and trying to outdo their competitors by driving innovation in the economy. Yeah. And I'm just very excited in particular, because I think it's a great way to speak to younger folks and to really get conservative folks more involved in the environmental conversation productively. And, you know, someone like John Curtis has been a really well outspoken voice on this, that there's conservative approaches to environmental improvement that are really underappreciated, and areas really where a lot of good limited government pro-market folks can really lead on these issues. And we can really have a lot more progress across the board.
Yeah, fantastic. Great insight. Devin Hartman is the R Street Institute's Director of Energy and Environmental Policy, and demonstrating we can have an and conversation when it comes to being careful stewards of the environment and making sure we're doing the right things, both in terms of spending, in terms of our communities, in terms of creating a better future together. Devin, thanks so much for joining us today. Great insight.
Thank you for having me.
All right, that's Devin Hartman from the R Street Institute. And again, it's an and conversation. It's not either or. Don't buy into the fake fight and the false choice. And when we make sure that that competition is rolling, rather than rewarding the lawyers and the lobbyists and giving big companies who don't need it money that they don't need but will take just to keep the competition out of the space, if we want real clean, real green, we got to make sure we're getting that competition engine firing as well. All right, we'll step aside for one last break. Final thoughts on Inside Sources coming up next. Stick around.
Boyd Matheson divides rage from reason on Inside Sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. It is great to be with you today. As always, I am Boyd Matheson, and as we round out the program today, I want to get to a thought that just keeps coming back to me of late, and that is that the real test of a nation is what it does when it doesn't have to do anything. So I want you to think about this a little bit different today. So the real test of a nation is, what does it do when it doesn't have to do anything? So, for example, a country that's facing a famine or dealing with an epidemic or confronting a large population stuck in intergenerational poverty, that's all they can focus on. They can't focus on anything else. But the success of the United States of America has it positioned with both the opportunity and the capacity to tackle some pretty significant challenges, not just here at home, but around the world. And yet so often we do the path of least resistance and we choose to ignore them because we can. It's a very un-American thing to do, but we're getting kind of good at it. We're getting really good at kicking cans down the road because we don't have to deal with it today. We can put it off. So dealing with something like Social Security, we can put that off for a while. It's not going to happen for another decade or so before it gets real trouble. So rather than take the political heat of doing something about it today, we'll just say everything's okay. It's good. Or we look at things like the $34 trillion of national debt. That will crush the economy. It will hurt the poor and the most vulnerable the most over time. And yet, nobody's calling for the payment. And so we're okay because we don't have to. Now, the challenge, the worry for me is this, is that when a country gets so good and so adept at solving problems, maximizing opportunities, that the question then becomes not about whether or not it can achieve something, it's will it? So if you look at some of the things that we've been able to do as a country, we got a pretty amazing list. Man on the moon, check. Cures for all kinds of diseases, check. Transcontinental Railroad, piece of cake. Interstate highway, got it done, check, check. Two world wars, a cold war, check, check, check. List goes on and on and on. We have all kinds of things we get done. And I actually agree with President Joe Biden, who often says it's hard to think of anything that a United States of America can't get done. And I think that is the danger of not just our society, but every advanced society, the ability to ignore problems. The luxury to ignore leads to the atrophy of that problem-solving muscle that built the nation in the first place. And so the more we kick cans down the road, the more we avoid the tough and unpleasant, uncomfortable conversation because we can, that muscle, that problem-solving muscle, that big idea muscle, that coming together to solve hard issues muscle atrophies. And then what? I'm convinced America does not have a capability problem when it comes to anything, whether it's being careful stewards of the land and dealing with the environment, whether it is about poverty and upward mobility, housing, health care, border security, immigration. We don't have a capability or a capacity problem. And sadly, the longer we put things off, eventually that luxury of the never-ending debate, which is sort of where we go now, because we don't have to. We have the luxury of not solving problems. So what do we do instead? We create fake fights and false choice and very long debates that are really good for politics and political campaigns, but are not good for solving problems. And many of our nation's problems are actually pretty simple to solve, not easy. Simple and easy are two different things. And sadly, in so many cases today, we don't even make a good attempt at addressing them anymore. And there are very few countries on this planet that have the luxury of debating and considering the pros and cons of whatever it is, building a border wall, reforming the criminal justice system, cutting or raising taxes, addressing health care costs, protecting the environment, reforming entitlement programs, reinventing the education system. It's not because there's a question about whether America can or cannot deal with any of those issues. Our problem is that we have become so comfortable in the mire and being mired in the political minutiae of debating or talking about things that we don't ever have to address them. It's this false sense of security that if we just argue about it, that's sufficient. Well, it's not, because it doesn't produce any solutions. Now, it's great for campaigns. It's good if you want to try to gain control of the House or the Senate or win the White House or win a local election. All good for that. So we have to get back to debating. Because if we don't get back to real debate about real issues with real results, then we just keep having this. I think contending with the great difficulties actually sharpens and strengthens the capacity of a country. I believe it was Abigail Adams who wrote that great necessities call out great virtues. And I'm one of those who still firmly and passionately believes that the American people will respond with unrivaled capacity and commitment when a leader with vision invites them to be part of a cause. Part of a cause, not a caustic debate. So just doing the social media battles, again, very interesting, not very important, rarely produces any results. And I think we're getting to that space where we no longer will have the luxury of procrastinating our pressing problems. Leaders are going to have to call on the citizens, and the citizens have to call on the leaders to recognize it's time to tackle the big issues of our time. All right, that wraps it up for us on Inside Sources today here on KSL News Radio. I'm Boyd Matheson. Thanks for joining us. And as always, as you go out into the world today, make sure you see something that inspires, say something that uplifts, and do something today that makes a difference.
KSL FM Midvale.
KSL Salt Lake City.
From the KSL Common Spirit Health Studios, this is KSL News Radio.
Utah's news, traffic, and weather station.